Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Sky Productions, world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Tis the season to be, well, bloody. I know that all of our shows are available all of the time, but this is our 2022 holiday special, where we dive into the highest profile gift that Santa left under our tree, Violent Night. Holiday horror has a long history. We've had lots and lots of Halloween horrors, some Easter terrors, Independence Day nightmares, and the like, though I'm still waiting for Eli Roth's Thanksgiving, whose faux trailer graced Grindhouse years ago. But the heartiest of holiday horrors are those centered around Christmas. Why is that? Is it because it is such a revered and wholesome family-oriented tradition that it's an easy target for transgression? There's something about Santa Claus and cookies and milk despoiled by rivulets of blood that hits the horror satisfaction button hard. I remember seeing David Cronenberg's Rabid for the first time and was witness to a shopping center Santa being killed by gunfire, and it was horrifying and hilarious at the same time. Christmas horror movies have been plentiful, perhaps kicked off by Bob Clark's 1974 holiday perennial Black Christmas, a clear influence on Carpenter's Halloween, and followed in no particular order by such titles as Christmas Evil, Gremlins, Jack Frost, Krampus, Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale, Christmas Evil, Better Watch Out, The Silent Night, Deadly Night series, Elves, Anna and the Apocalypse, Home for the Holidays, and so many more. But the latest sanguinary snowstorm to hit the screen may be the bloodiest. Violent Night is a major studio movie backed by a huge ad campaign and release pattern that bodes well for our plucky little genre. There's a ton of horror cred in the people who made this film, from Norwegian director Tommy Wirkola, whose Dead Snow made an international sensation on its release in 2009, to the screenwriters Josh Miller and Pat Casey, who wrote the way better than anyone expected Sonic the Hedgehog movies. Josh also created and co-hosts the excellent Best Movies Never Made podcast. We'll take a deep dive with all three of them into the giddy heights of holiday horror right now. So Tommy, starting out in Norway, how does somebody become a filmmaker in Norway? And were there dreams of Hollywood in your sugar plums and dreams of Hollywood in your head?
Well, dreams for sure, but it was never, when I was a kid, it was never a realistic dream. I'm from the very, very north of Norway, like above the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So there was really only two directors ever to come out of that whole region. And one of them was actually Oscar nominated in 86, I believe, for a movie called Pathfinder. So he was kind of the shining light. We all like, okay, that would be amazing. But it was such a big leap to take, say you want to be a director or be anything with film. So I'm actually educated to be a plumber. And then that didn't work out.
Same job.
Yeah, that didn't work out well. So I started IT. That didn't work out really either. I fell asleep at every lecture. So I decided, okay, I got to do the one thing I'm really passionate about that I love more than anything else, which is film. And So I started media production, it was called, in my local town, and I went to film school in Australia, of all places.
Really?
Yeah, because in Norway, obviously, the pros of socialism is that you get free schools, and they also actually give you money if you want to go abroad to study. So I literally looked at the map and what is the furthest away from my hometown I can get? There's the northern Norway. There's the east coast of Australia. I think I want to go there. So I started film at Bond University at the Gold Coast. And it was there I met a lot of my core crew, actually. So my production designer, my DP, my producer, and a camera, like, we were all a gang together there, and we came up together and we made Kill Bill You and the Dead Snow movies.
So the Dead Snow movies, how do you, is there a healthy Norwegian cinema?
Yes, there is, but I'm from, again, like, there's, you have something called the NFI, and the NFI is basically the government program for film, and they, you have to apply and they give you money. But obviously, I never, for any movie I ever made, gotten money out of the official, like, Norwegian NFI system.
They don't like to support horror films,
no.
Most of these government agencies.
No, not at all. And genre movie, when I grew up, was absent in Norway. Like, I think there was two genre films ever made until the 90s, like, horror movies. And then there was one that kind of made waves and was also made independently, and then came Dead Snow. And it's like it showed the path. Okay, people in Norway actually want to see horror movies, and there's a market for it. And those movies became hits. But yeah, no, it was very hard to get it made, actually. And my first film was a super low budget comedy called Kill Bill You, which is a spoof on the Kill Bill series.
Yeah.
And we made that, just, we had a crew of 10, and we just made it. I starred in the film with my friends, and it was just like, it's a miracle. But we got a cinematic release, and it became a hit. And that,
wow.
And every single cent we made on that film, we just poured into Dead Snow.
Yeah, well, the production values of Dead Snow belie a very low cost. And I would guess that that's from all of the things you learned at film school in Australia.
Yeah, yeah. And also, like, it helped that we had done, like, five or six shorts together in Australia. And we came to Norway, did our first film, then Dead Snow. But Dead Snow was a massive undertaking for us. Like, we really didn't... We had a professional lighting crew for the first time, and we had, like, it was just suddenly professionals around us, even though the crew was small. And we shot it in around my hometown, which no movies shoot there. And, like, again, like, it works, but my inexperience was, like, for example, I wanted to put this cabin in the mountain because it looks so good, but there's no roads there. But we got a helicopter to fly in the shell of the cabin. And then we had, the only way in and out on set was snowmobiles. And in hindsight, like, why didn't we just put it next to a road at least? I was so inexperienced, and all of us were.
Well, it had to have been a big surprise when it became such an international hit. It sold in territories all around the world, including here.
Yeah, yeah. No, it played in Sundance, and it's still, to this day, one of the best screenings I ever attended was the midnight screening in Sundance.
Yeah.
And that was what started it all, and it was my love letter to the horror comedy genre. Again, like, nothing done like that in Norway ever before, and I grew up loving that stuff.
What were your favorites?
If I have to pick one, I would say the eye opener for me with two movies was Evil Dead 2 and Brain Dead Alive. Like,
yeah,
because I especially remember Brain Dead. It was like the amount of gore, but how funny it was. It was like, oh my God, you can actually do both these things. So that really made a mark on me. So that was kind of the beginning of it. And we made, again, like, we made it mostly with our friends, but with a few more professionals. We got distribution and we sold after Sundance, and that got me an agent. And then I got over here.
So your choice to do a horror movie was not a cynical financial move, but because you have passion for the genre.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, after my first film, I told my writing partner, I really want to do a Nazi zombie movie.
Yeah, which is a subgenre of its own.
Yeah, yes.
Shockwaves. I've seen so many. And that was made in Florida on 16mm.
Oh, really? Yeah.
With Peter Cushing. Yeah.
Yeah, Peter Cushing was in it. And I remember, but again, like, in the northern Norway, we have a very strong World War II history. The northern Norway was, it's not a lie, a lot of the backstory in the movie, they hid their biggest warships in the fjords there to... Mm. threatened the convoy between Russia and England. So we had so many high-level Nazis and ships and equipment up in the north. So many stories and legends and myths when I grew up. So we just tapped into that, basically. Then I remember when we sold the film to the investors, like, yeah, what's the worst thing than a zombie? A Nazi zombie.
So, Josh and Pat, you guys are also big fans of the genre. What were the, Josh, you first, what were your movies that kicked your ass?
I mean, similar to Tommy's, Pat and I are both from Minnesota, which is kind of the Norway.
The American Norway.
of America, both climate and...
I do feel like there's something about being cooped up in the winter that makes you love horror extra somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, Evil Dead 2, I guess it's kind of a cliche for filmmakers. But I think the way I always articulate it was Evil Dead 2 specifically, but most of Sam Raimi's stuff was the first movies that I really saw where I really got the idea of like, oh, he's like directing, like he's using directing almost like acting. Like he's really controlling
the tools camera. Of cinema. Yeah. It's got a personality.
It's not just the Altman, you know, Clint Eastwood, I put the camera in the corner and I cast it well. And like,
right. Another valid way to make movies, the beauty of the horror genre is that you can be expressive with the tools, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that was really liberating. We became friends in high school and started making movies immediately. And just knowing that, you know, we didn't have, like, we never even made it as far as Tommy, as far as, like, let's really, like, raise money. We had a movie that got, our first movie that got released on DVD. God bless the early 2000s DVD boom, where distributors were just like, is it 90 minutes long? We'll take it. Well, yeah. But we made a movie called Hey, Stop Stabbing Me that cost about $500. We didn't even, like, the idea of, like, how do you even raise money was
Tommy's
beyond
like,
us.
A crew of 10. And I'm like, 10?
Wow.
You got
it,
two.
It was really just the two
ooh
of
la
us.
La,
anyone
Tommy.
Who was standing nearby would be like, hold this, you know?
But definitely Sam Raimi. I mean, for me, definitely early Peter Jackson as well. And then early Stuart Gordon. I think Reanimator was very much a movie for me where, you know, it's a horror comedy, but at the same time, I almost like don't like calling it a horror comedy because it's not that it's going for overt laughs. It's
right.
It's like perfectly straddling the idea.
Yeah, because most horror comedies are neither funny nor horrific.
Yeah.
they kind of give up both sides. But one of the beautiful things about Dead Snow and its sequel, Dead Snow 2, Red versus Dead, and particularly Violent Night, their Violent Night had me in stitches. I mean, the funny stuff is really funny, and the gory stuff is really gory, and there's a lot of tension in it and the like, and it manages to walk a very fine razor wire. Yeah.
And for us, like, pitching it, we couldn't believe anyone got so excited about it along the process. We always figured it was the kind of pitch you tell somebody, and they go, like, we can't make that, though, you know? But that everyone on board seem to really get and want to like protect the tone because it could go wrong in any different way. And so we're excited when our producers were like, we're gonna show the script to Tommy because we're like, oh, well, I mean, he gets it, like,
definitely.
And so when he responded to it so positively, it really felt like, wow, we might actually get this the way we imagine, because we always assumed if we sold it, it would get turned into like a PG, like Paul Blart kind of Christmas, you know. Or oddly enough, strip out most of the comedy and like push it too far in the just like R-rated action space.
Yeah, it was kind of a delicate balance, but yeah, definitely Tommy totally got it. And so we wound up with everybody trying to make the same movie, which is kind of a miracle, you know.
So how did it come to you, Tommy? Did it come through an agent? Was there a pitch? Was there a script already?
There was a script already. It was the producers sent it to me. I knew them from way back. Dave Leach, Kelly McCormick, and Guy Nanella are the producers. And Dave Leach actually directed Second Unit on Hansel and Gretel. Before he became one of the biggest directors in the world. So we became friends on that, and we've been keeping in touch, and I got to know Kelly and then Guy, and And Guy had just started working for them. And he, the first meeting they had, because I think Dave was considering directing it himself for a while.
Yeah.
And then he stepped away to do Bullet Train. And I think it was Guy who said, wait, what about Tommy? Is he too obvious?
Sometimes the obvious is the right choice.
Yeah. No, and I read it. I loved it. And I, again, the mix of tones is what I love. And it was all there. And yeah, I jumped on. And again, like one of the first things I said was, I really want to try to make it a Christmas movie because I know we can do the action and the gore and all that stuff and the crazy humor, but I really want to try to embrace the heart because that, to me, could be a really interesting combination. So that was kind of my way in, I guess.
Yeah. What do you think, Pat, the appeal is for holiday horror? We talked about in the introduction and the like, but why do you think they're so popular, particularly Christmas?
I mean, just the juxtaposition, I suppose, and like that most Christmas movies are so sappy sweet that people who aren't that sappy sweet really want something that's the opposite, that they can still get into the Christmas spirit.
Where you're sick to death of the carols around you everywhere you go.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, with this movie, we're kind of trying to do both at once because to try and get that Christmas, the Christmas magic, which, I don't know, like making a movie, like what you're really after always is just like those moments of movie magic, which is sort of like indescribable, like what makes movie magic, but you know it when you're feeling it. Right. And there's also Christmas magic, which is sort of related. Yeah. But to try and get all of that in with like ridiculous over-the-top violence and that kind of Evil Dead 2 kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, because like Gremlins, which is another, I think, seminal for me growing up. But
that's
I did
the making
that I would
of.
Say, that's a movie that I would say is taking the idea of like, aren't you sick of Christmas movies and kind of trying to mess with it? But we, yeah, as Pat was saying, we were kind of like, well, is there a way to do it where we are, in fact, embracing? Like, we're like, no, this is like a Christmas movie that's supposed to give you, it's not going to have the Phoebe Cates, you know, monologue. Like, right. You want to get the warm fuzzies while you're also seeing people's heads getting chopped off.
I also have, like, the anti-Christmas stuff, which was part of it, was, like, because we start off, you know, he is kind of a bad Santa, like, just at the top of the film. To give you the biggest swing to come back around to the warm fuzzies by the end of the movie, you know?
Well, let's go back a little bit because I'm interested in the trajectory of all your careers. But Tommy, after doing the Dead Snow movies and finally getting an opportunity with Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters to do a Hollywood movie, tell me about that transition and what it was like for you.
Well, it was, the idea actually spawned in Australia in film school. We had this thing called Script Writing 2, I believe this was one called. And part of that class was a pitch. And we had 1 minute each, and we got grade on the pitch. And I didn't have much. I went up before the teachers, and I said, all right, Hansel and Gretel, 15 Years Later, and the Witch Hunters. And one of the teachers actually said to me, Tommy, don't ever mention this idea ever again until in front of a Hollywood producer, and I guarantee you will sell it. So I kept my mouth shut. I went back and did the Kabulia and Dead Snow, and in Sundance I got an agent, and I went to LA for the first time closely after, and I only made like a one sheet. I had some ideas to pitch before, and I waited with Hansel and Gretel to last, and I met with my first meeting the first day was with Adam McKay, his company. It was McKay and those guys, because their producer had, by chance, he was not a horror fan at all, but he had been dragged in by his friend to see Dead Snow. And he had loved it. And he had called my agent and said, make sure that we're the first meeting Tommy has when he comes to LA.
Wow, that's a nice entry.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Red carpet.
Yeah, so first meeting, first day, I pitched that file. I ended the pitch with Hansel and Gretel. And I actually remember seeing Adam McKay and Kevin Messing just looking at each other. Yeah, that sounds interesting.
1 minute's the perfect length for a pitch.
Yeah. No, and they took me to Paramount. I'm not joking, the day after, and we sold it. And I understand it's never been that easy again after.
Yeah. I was going to say, those listening at home, this is not the norm.
No. No, but that said, it was a big transition, obviously. And I'm not going to lie that the movie is very far away from the script I wrote. Mm. And the studio was very hands-on, in pre-production and production, especially in post-production. And also for me, just directing a movie with suddenly 200 people in the crew, like it's a cliche to say it, but I literally had to pretend I knew what I was doing the first. I remember the first day, and this is such a weird, like, first day they were lighting, and they bring these two people in, the same costume as Jeremy and Gemma. I was like, wait, who are those people? Why are you doing a set? Those are the doubles. What do you mean? You actually use doubles to light?
You mean the actors don't do this
yeah,
part?
Yeah. It was such a shock to me, like, and a luxury, of course, but that was the first day.
But there's a new machine that you're not used to. And,
exactly.
And I'm just curious how you dealt with that. Well, it had to be every day there was something new that you'd not experienced before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And especially, I'm mixed on this because I have to give credit to Paramount and the regime at that time because they gave me a shot. It was a $65 million movie. I'd done like nothing before that. And it's my script, and they said, go make it. But as we started making it, a little bit in pre-production, but mostly in production and post-production, they really started getting their hands in there and said, oh, we can't do this. We can't
do that. A little late.
Yeah, I know. And we were in Germany shooting it. So I would shoot during the day, and I would have these Skype sessions during night. And they would like give me notes of the scenes they were shooting the next week, and I had to rewrite. Like, it was a very little, it was just such a shock course, I guess, into the studio studios and how they can work. And it became really muddled, and especially in post production when they just now cut that. Like, there was, they really, and I get it, like, in hindsight, the movie did really well financially, but critically it got slammed really hard.
How does that feel? I mean, I've gone through this too.
Yeah.
And it's not fun, but, you know, you were fresh and new and you just made your first Hollywood movie.
Yeah, no, it was tough. And especially because I felt like, God damn it, this is not the film I wanted to make. No.
You had to defend it in the face of knowing that you were forced to change it.
Yeah, and at least I did. I mean, I guess I did it for my friends and me, but I also knew I can't say that to the press. I just looked like I'm making excuses and I don't want
to... And not get hired again.
Exactly. But it was a huge learning curve for me, especially how to deal with the studio and the politics and how to... There's a cliche that you learn when you come here is that choose your battles. So I'd heard that. And in the beginning, especially the script process and in production, I kind of said yes to too many things probably.
Yeah.
And then in post-production, I started fighting on everything.
I discovered on Sleepwalkers that if you are amenable to their changes, too amenable to their changes, they think they can roll you over easily.
Yeah, and I was probably in the beginning, and I, like, sure, because I wanted to be that guy, I wanted to get everybody's notes and thoughts, and I want to be, because I heard that, choose your battles. I got to wait for the big ones, but then I started realizing, God damn, I've given up this, I've given up that, I've given up, where's my movie going? So in the post-production, I really started to fight for things, and I think they just got sick of me. But I have to get again. I had amazing producers, Adam McKay, Will Farrell. They really fought for it, and so did Jeremy Renner. And but in the end, it was just it was a movie that ended up in between things.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why I went back and did Dead Snow 2, because I just needed to have fun again and cleanse myself. And literally a lot of that rewriting or writing that script was just like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. I'm going to show them. It was a lot. And I think you can see that in the film. There's a lot of like almost aggression in some of those sequences.
Yeah,
like, I'm going to show people I can do all these things.
Plus, and it's so much bigger than the first one in scale.
Yeah.
That had to have come from the confidence of carrying a $65 million movie on your shoulders.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And because the first one had done really well and sold so much, we got a lot more money. And we shot it in Iceland because they had a rebate. We couldn't shoot in Norway. And it was really fun. And it was a great... It's probably... That, and I would say Violent Night and The Trip are my three favorite films. But Dead Snow 2, especially because it was such a... After Hansel and Gretel, I was really, really like depressed and was like, oh God, this is going to be tough doing another film again. Like, but then I Dead Snow 2, and it felt great again.
It refreshed you.
Yeah.
Gave you your passion back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Pat and Josh, you jumped right into the deep end with Sonic the Hedgehog, major studio movie base with a movie star attached and based on a hugely successful video game and all that. So tell me about the process of how you guys made that happen. First, how you got the job, how you pitched it.
Yeah,
I would say I don't know if we jumped into the deep end because we've been kicking around for years and years before that.
Yeah, but our breakthrough was a big one.
For sure. I mean, our arrival was a lot less exciting than Tommy here in L.A. We did the classic, just load our car up with all our stuff and drive out here.
And we're feeling pretty good because of Hey Stop Stabbing Me and how good that had been, but it's not like it had become a hit or anything, but we had this calling card that then no one ever really watched. Like
regular audience. It was like enough people in the industry saw it. I mean, oddly enough, not to skip ahead, but Violent Night came about in part because one of the first people to reach out to us for Hey Stop Stab Me was a guy named Keith Calder, who started a company called Snoot. Who, for genre fans, I would say probably best known that they made the initial wave of Adam Wingard, Simon Barrett movies, Year Next, The Guest, and the Blair Witch sequel, reboot, I guess, sequel,
call sequel, it? Reboot, sequel boot, sequel. C-boot.
but in a roundabout way, they kind of helped kickstart the pitching process on Violent Night. But yeah, it's basically after really no one saw Violent or Hey Stop Stabbing Me, so we were kind of just...
Although it is available on a Blu-ray anniversary 20th edition right
anniversary
now.
From Woo-hoo! Several films.
Only took you another 15 years to get your studio movie.
Yeah, but it was... we're kicking around for like 10 years just doing the most independent of indie movies. And then we got an animated show on Fox called Golan the Insatiable, which we also loved that no one watched.
Which is kind of the story of our lives. Yeah, like always very, very little advertising. And what advertising our stuff got was always extremely bad as well.
But also like, Hey Stop Stop Me, just the right number of people in the industry liked Golan. And one of those was a guy named Toby Asher, who was an up-and-comer producer at Neil Moritz's company.
Uh-huh.
And so he brought us in just for a general because of Golan the Insatiable. And, you know, like we're in your office here and looking around at all the nice stuff you have. And Toby had a bunch of Sonic the Hedgehog stuff. And we're just like, oh, are you making a Sonic movie?
Yeah, basically like, can we write it? We should do this. We just told him we should do the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
So they were going to do it regardless. They were already in development.
And they already had writers on it. He was like, calm down. We were like, okay, well, after this fails, call us. So I think we made that bold claim. And then a couple of months later, he actually did. He was like, do you guys really have an idea for the Sonic the Hedgehog movie?
So they had been in development with it, but they weren't happy with
it. Yeah, it stalled out creatively. Yeah. I think the take they were doing was like very meta. And I think ultimately people were just like, I don't know if this movie should be so meta. But we didn't know that. So it was.
So we got the call to come in basically fresh as though it was a new thing and kind of engage in some sort of pitch bake-off where we pitched, you know, Sega and Neil and various things. And then
our Moritz pitch was particularly hilarious because he was, I think, in Cuba doing one of the Fast and Furious movies.
Oh my God.
And it was before Zoom, so it was just like over the phone. And we were told we had like 45 minutes, and he gets on and we're told, like, actually, you only have like 25 minutes. Or he says that. And he's like, so I'm just not going to interrupt you guys. Go. So we're just like pitching over the phone into this silent void.
He was having lunch.
Probably in the bathroom. But then it goes to the end and he's like, I love it. Thanks, guys. I got to go. And we're
like, That's exactly the feedback you want, right?
So somehow we got that job, even though, we'd never done a big movie before. Like, we'd never even really gotten a chance to. It's not like we'd like written a script for a big movie that had not gone even.
And we hadn't really done any family stuff.
Yeah,
we'd done two Hot Wheels animated things that weren't straight to video, but it was that style format. They were like 40 minutes long, but that was for like 4-year-olds.
Yeah, later our agent told us that he couldn't believe it, that he was like, that we talked ourselves into that job based on nothing.
Yeah, because we had no feature samples to show them in the family space.
But this is the first one you can talk to people about who say, oh, you did that?
For sure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
you know?
It's always that weird, like, you know, you're in the dentist and like, what do you do? And it's like, oh, I'm a writer. And then you just know they're going to say, have you done anything I've seen? And you're just like, no.
Yeah, it's like you don't want to like list off all your credits.
I always pull the hocus pocus card.
Yes, yeah, hocus pocus. But now we have our hocus pocus.
But yeah, so
yeah,
Sonic,
exactly.
Proved to be, after kind of a rough launch, like, proved to be very successful, and audiences really liked it and won us a lot of goodwill.
And it got good reviews, which you don't expect for that kind of movie.
Yeah. I mean, we were hoping for it. We thought the movie was good.
Yeah, absolutely. People, like I said in the introduction, it was so much better than people anticipated because it didn't need to be that good to be successful.
And that was why we were very happy that people liked 2, because we're kind of like, well, you only get that once, the lower expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
We're like, now we really got to deliver on part 2.
But it was, we went out to pitch. It was when Sonic 1 was coming out. Or like when it was about to come out, we were kind of like, oh, we should go out with like a pitch right now. But we weren't sure what to do. And so we gathered with our reps and kind of ran them through a list of ideas. that didn't have Violent Night on it, and then like that was kind of a last throw-in bonus one, and was like, oh, and we also
just
have
verbal
thing,
only. Yeah.
That we've got this thing that's sort of like it's like Die Hard, but with Santa, and like we are all like, oh my god, tell us about that. And it was the next day, our agent Mike Goldberg talked to Kelly McCormick and mentioned it, and Kelly liked the idea, and then he called us immediately and was like, can you guys have lunch with David Leitch tomorrow and like pitch him this movie?
He's in town briefly.
And we were like, I mean, we weren't ready, but we were like, yeah! and kind of got our pitch together like that morning, and then went and had the lunch, and then it all came together very fast, because we were then out pitching studios the week Sonic 1 premiered. Like, at
good
the Sonic
timing.
1 premiere, we were at, you know, partying afterwards, and then again, our agents were like, you guys got to go home. You have four pitches tomorrow. We were like, oh, right.
So, Tommy, what were you looking for at the time? Was this in your wheelhouse, or were you trying to do something within the genre, outside the genre?
Well, I guess I always wanted to do like a more of a traditional action movie, action flick, but I have a big love for the 80s and 90s action movies. And
like what?
All of Shane Black's stuff, I would say, I love. Yeah. Truly love. And I feel like I actually rewatched not long ago with my girlfriend The Midnight Run as well. Like those kind of movies, oh, yeah. I feel like I just disappeared. And really, really R-rated stuff, but real characters, but really fun. And also, like, this is like me just, sorry, just side note, but I miss movies where it's not just about the one or two or three main characters, where the henchmen and the side, like, have an arc or a great moment or a great piece of dialogue. And yeah, that was, I mean, when I read that script, I felt like a lot of those things that I love, the action movies I loved growing up was there. But I really hadn't, because I was actually still finishing my previous film called The Trip here in the US. Kelly, Dave, and Guy saw an early cut of it while I was still finishing post, and they, based on that, wanted to send me by that night. So I really hadn't enough time to think about what I want to do next before they sent me the script.
You were still finishing up.
Yeah. So that was probably June, July, maybe, of last year, really. So
wow, things happen fast.
So then I came on board and
tell me about your first meeting with the guys, with the writers.
Well, unsurprisingly, it was over Zoom.
Yes.
Are these days. I guess the most notable thing about it was I was helping my podcast, which Mick has been on.
Yeah.
You should go back and listen to his episode about
podcast.
His unmade mummy movie.
Yeah.
Two
of them.
Yeah. but our podcast is currently on hiatus because Steve, my co-host, is finishing his new doc, which is called Sharksploitation.
Oh.
It's about exactly what it sounds like, the history of the shark movie subgenre. But awesome. We were in New England getting interviews, so I had to Zoom from the backseat of a car
driving
Boston to Connecticut.
Oh, God.
you kept falling out.
Like, they just sent us, that cut of The Trip, so I had just watched that, and I absolutely loved it.
Now,
too.
I haven't seen The
really
Trip.
Adored.
I don't know about The Trip.
It's great. I was just going to say, I knew Tommy from his horror movies, and not like we were like, can he do a non-horror movie? But but we were talking about that with Guy, and he's like, you got to see his new one. So he sent us a link, and everyone should watch. It's on Netflix, right?
Yeah. So yes, it got theatrical in Norway, but Netflix bought the rest of the world. It's got a very generic title here called The Trip.
Yeah. So there've been a lot of movies with that title.
Yes.
But I remember Pat and I watched. I think we were texting each other during the movie, and we don't want to spoil anything, so I can't exactly say what we were saying, but there was
no, because I'm gonna watch it tonight,
but there is a certain element of the movie where we were like, if the payoff at the ending of this is blank, that this guy will 100% get Violent Night.
Yeah, it's totally some similarities to Violent Night, that the combination of ultra violence and really dark humor, but also some art.
And it's probably the darkest film. I mean, you think you'll enjoy it. It's super. Yeah,
I'm just surprised I didn't know about it, and that's because it's Netflix.
Yeah, it's also local language. It was a Norwegian film because I was just to sidetrack on that. I was just put a student in the U.S. Then the pandemic hit, so we just recast it and shot it in Norway because Norway wasn't that hit that hard. But yeah, that was the film basically that landed me by that night, because the studio also saw it and they loved it, and that was it. And
so did you have the guys pitch you when you were on the phone, or was it a two-way conversation?
No,
three-way conversation?
I guess it was more me saying my thoughts on that call, was it?
I'm trying to remember, because you'd already read the script,
yeah,
right?
I had read the script at this point, because we were talking about, already we were talking about going to find our Santa, and because I think the script was what we went out with. We didn't do rewrites before we sent out, did we? I can't remember.
It all happened so fast. It's funny, because my memory of that Zoom from the backseat of a car was more, it was more like a kickoff meeting.
Yeah.
Like it was
so
kind of like we all just
we're decided, already on board. Yeah. What do we do next?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really what we were talking about. Whether or not, I don't remember if the second draft happened before we went out to actors, but we definitely were already kind of talking about like, what do we got to do to get this into shooting shape?
Yeah.
So Tommy, what were some of the things that you wanted to do to make it ready?
Well, first of all, the first thing was a budget thing. Is there was some big stuff in there that I knew we had to take out, because when Leach was just considering directing it, there was a much higher budget. So when I came aboard, it was going to fit on the parameter around 20.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some stuff, including this big sleigh helicopter chase fight sequence at the end with a bazooka.
I would have loved to have seen it. It would have been great.
Made it in Norway for $20 million, you could have done that.
That's true. So we got the snowmobiles in instead, because I love snowmobiling where I'm from. So that, and I always loved snowmobiles in movies, and I feel like they're so rare. You have Die Hard 2, and you have one of the James Bonds, and Inception are the only one I can think of that have a good snowmobile sequence. But other than that, it was just small stuff here and there. I remember one of the bigger things I asked for was that big face-off with the bad guy and Santa in the middle of the film.
Which was definitely a note that we didn't mind getting, because as soon as you said it, I mean, we were like, oh, yeah.
Lights went on.
Because that's usually the note we get. We had to write the movie so fast that in some sense we couldn't give ourselves our own notes. Because that was one of our big Sonic the Hedgehog Part 1 notes, was we was like, there was a whole version where Robotnik and Sonic like don't really.
No, but that wasn't a note that came from the studio.
No, I'm saying
anything.
From us.
Yeah, it's like they had other notes for like the second draft of Sonic the Hedgehog. They were like, "You got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do that," and we were like, "Okay, but the most important one is coming from us, is that we got to get Sonic and Robotnik a face to face earlier in the movie." And they were like, "We don't care about that." We're like, "We're doing it anyway.
Yeah,
trust us."
So yeah, so when Tommy gave that note, we were like, "Oh, duh! What are we doing over here?"
So Tommy, you'd girded your loins from your previous studio experience on Hansel and Gretel. So you went in. How was the experience during development with the script? Was there a lot of input this time?
No, I have to say there was the complete opposite. They were so supportive, and they were so, I think they understood as well, and they realized that we won't have the budget of a Marvel movie. We got to compensate in other places. We got to have attitude and fun and crazy action. And I don't think we ever got a no. I was a couple of times I was sure they're going to have a reaction at some of the rewrites. But no, never. The only pushback I got was actually from the producers when I pitched. There's a scene where Santa isn't in the basement and he's pulling things up out of his bag to try to find some stuff he can use for the fight. And at one point I had, what if he pulls up like this giant dildo and anal beads that is for Gertrude, the older lady in the house. But
it's an R after all.
Yeah. That was when I said, like, maybe not Tommy. Right. But other than that, no, it was very, and again, like in post, the most extreme stuff in dialogue and shocking moments, they actually wanted more of. Can we extend this moment? And so that was really surprising in the best way. And we always, I have to say, it gave me belief that you can actually make these films here, and they are just supportive. It was a great experience.
Universal.
Like, I wonder how much like our title really like created the atmosphere for the studio to really embrace.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was like when we went out to pitch it, we didn't have the title. We were just calling it Die Hard Santa. unless Die Hard's lawyers are listening, in which
then
case it was just called Regular Santa.
Yeah. But it's kind of like Die Hard. Yeah.
But it was like in that meeting with Universal, I think they were like, do you have a title? And we were like, I mean, probably some kind of Christmas pun, like Violent Night, or they were like, oh my God!
Stop!
You know, like, stopped us before we got to our second idea.
What was the second idea?
I don't remember. We did have a whole list.
I mean, all sorts of dumb puns. Wreck the Hall.
I think we said Violent Night first, because it was probably the best of the puns.
Yeah.
So, during the actual casting process, were you guys all involved, or was it primarily in your hands, Tommy?
Well, funnily enough, they didn't tell me this way later, but they when they were writing it, they envisioned Harbor as the perfect Santa. And for my end, like, it was it was an early casting meeting. You know how you get these lists from agencies and all that stuff. And it was me and the producers. And I wonder if one of the studio execs was there as well. Maybe anyway, we're going through these names. And I can't remember who, but somebody, what about David Harbour? And it was literally one of those moments where you just all look at each other and said, yes, he's absolutely perfect.
And he's one of those guys where you go, oh, it's that guy. You might not know his name, but you're that guy. I've seen him in 100 movies.
Yes. Plus, we all tell them, like, Hopper from, you know, Stranger Things.
Right.
Yeah, no, and he, I think we got the script to him, like, only a couple of days later, and he was shooting in New Orleans. I Skyped with him the next week, and he was on board and loved the script, loved the humor and the character, and saw what could be done with it. And his
were there new ideas that he brought into
the character? Many during the process. He was adamant, like many things, like, but to ground it, he really wanted to play it as grounded as humanly possible. He also wanted the physical transformation to be complete from the Coca-Cola scent that we knew. He really liked the round glasses and the perfect beard and all that stuff. And we had a lot of fun kind of revealing the layers, what's revealed in each fight. And he was very, like, again, like, one of the things he had issues with was the, and again, because it goes against his instincts, like, was the one-liners.
Yeah.
Yeah, original draft was just wall-to-wall Christmas one-liners.
But, yeah, he also understands that marketing will want him, and to be fair, the marketing are using the hell out of those.
Yeah.
Even though they're not in the film. But, yeah, like, see, he was always about, okay, what, but I gotta play this as a real character. I'm not gonna say these things to myself and I'm alone in the hallway saying this cool Christmas line. But yeah.
But you love degrade. He's sort of degraded like Bruce Campbell in a Sam Raimi movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. He loved that stuff and he loved playing it deadpan again. Like he every and we, me and him talked really early on that the moment we try to be funny with it, it's not gonna be funny.
Right.
We gotta trust the script and the setting and
comedy that tries too hard is never funny. It's painful.
Yeah. I mean, that was always the idea, was to basically play it like a real action movie. I mean, when people were like, what makes the bad guys funny? We were like, nothing. They're exactly the bad guys from the straight version of this.
And yeah, that's
they
why
ended
it's
up
funny.
Being so funny.
Yeah.
Because it was so deadpan, you know?
Yeah.
Tell me more about the casting process and working with kids, because that's always a challenge, not just because they're kids, but because your hours are shortened when you're working with them as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, after Harbour, we cast Scrooge, which was John Leguizamo. And that was Dave Leach who suggested, because he had worked with him on John Wick.
Yeah, that would be a totally unexpected casting choice, too, and it's brilliant.
And brilliant. And the moment he suggested, I said, yeah, of course, if we can have him. And he read the script, loved it, and he put so much of himself in that character. He loves to ad-lib. He's so good at coming up funny lines.
Yeah.
And he really gave that role personality. But one of the things also we put in the script, something I guess I can't I don't think it was there the, no there wasn't the fact that he
speech.
Has the fact that he has a personal
it was a later ad.
Hate for Christmas. We wanted to add a layer to him and make it personal at the end fight, not just about the money, and he loved that kind of stuff. But he's also the funniest guy ever and such a sweet man. Beverly D'Angelo was because of Christmas Vacation, one of my favorite Christmas
movies.
Yeah,
and we haven't seen her in years.
Yeah.
And was this a comeback for her?
Yeah, sort of, I guess. And she, you know, she had the kids very late in life, and she kind of stepped away from acting for a long time. She had twins when she was 49, 50, and she stepped away. And I guess this could be called sort of a comeback. And she was so fun, and so she loved that character and loved the swearing part of it for some reason. Loved to improvise there. And yet, then we had to cast Trudy because we knew the little girl. We knew that was the heart of the film, Santa and little girl, and their relationship.
You had to get Natalie Wood,
and she, you know, as you do with kids, you read so many kids and looked at so many tapes, and finally she came across her, and I think she just had that innocence and sweetness, obviously, and a lot of them are great actors, but the test is when you read them and you see how well they understand the humor and it can take direction. And she really got the jokes. And she really understood how she had to play it for it to be funny or sweet. And
so you didn't need to do line readings or anything with her?
No, and Harbour actually, he was also very good when it came to her. And he obviously had experience from Stranger Things. But he came on set every day when they're doing the walkie scenes, and he was there with her on the other side and really helped that process. And she also had a mom who was great when it comes to the tone of the film. She understood that, so she read with her every night and before set, so she was so well prepared when she came on set. And she actually improvised a few things, like the when she's swinging that punching bag. She was screaming, "Incoming!" It was like, oh, that's brilliant.
Like that.
Yeah. So that was again, like we added more of that in the process after I came in, because I thought if we can make people believe in this relationship and if we can make them care about that, we can go as crazy as we want on the rest.
So you had no challenges because she was so good.
Yeah, no, there was. I have to say, it takes a little longer, and she has, of course, she had to have school every day, and she has hours she has to keep, and we had a great double we could use at times. The hardest part of the shoot was actually, it was a very aggressive schedule, and it was just insanely cold.
How many days?
I think it was originally 38, but we got a few more days. So I think 41, something like that.
But the cold was unbelievable. Like, Josh and I were only there for the first part of the shoot, but it was like the highs were negative 20. Like,
and Fahrenheit. Where exactly was it shot?
In Winnipeg.
Oh, yes. Northern Canada.
That's where we always joke. It's like they managed to find the one place that's consistently colder than both Minnesota and Northern Norway.
and we got the hell out of there before they started on the night exteriors. I can't even imagine. Like,
yeah, have a good time, Tommy.
Back to LA.
It was 3 weeks of night exterior and minus 25 is 30 Celsius. And just always with Winnipeg. And I'm used to that kind of temperature, but I'm not used to the constant wind. It's always a little bit of wind just hitting you, piercing your clothes. It's like uncomfortable, and the actors are grumpy, and the crew are grumpy. Like,
night exteriors are difficult anyway.
Yeah.
But with that added, it had to have been miserable.
It was, but part of me, I don't know why, maybe I'm, I get a kick out of things. I get a kick out of it when people are miserable. if other people are complaining or like I get energy out of that. And you're able to
be the guiding force.
Yeah. Yes. And I grew up in that. I kind of used to it, but it was painfully cold. And there was one night it was the only night we canceled shooting. It was when the oil inside the dolly froze.
Oh,
we couldn't
my God.
Get up and down anymore. It's like, let's just go home.
Yeah, I think that's a wrap.
Yeah.
So were there any scenes that were shot but were not included? Anything that you miss, Pat and Josh?
I mean, we miss the one-liners just because we love them so much. But I don't really feel like there was one scene that they didn't shoot that kind of kept popping in and out of the script up until the last minute and then didn't get shot.
Yeah, there was like an extra just scene of Die Hardy kind of suspense.
That we miss a bit, but I don't know. As far as like what they shot, not everything should make it in.
Yeah, there was a little bit more about his origin that I think got cut kind of for pacing, but also to leave some mystery for perhaps if, knock on wood, this is a success, we can dig into that a little deeper later. And there was the alternate ending, which was fun.
That's a big one. The movie was not supposed to end the way it did, and because the whole idea was that through this journey, Santa, and he learns through Trudy that he can actually do more. He's not just about delivering presents. He can use his powers to actually physically do stuff and help people. So we shot this scene as well, and it was some of the finest acting Harbert did actually. There's a montage in the beginning of the movie where Santa goes through all these houses, and this one house particularly was a little girl sleeping in bed while the dad is drunk in the sofa or in the chair with his beer on the side, basically being a bad dad. And we go back there at the end, and this guy wakes up and his beer is gone, and then he's Santa sitting in the corner in the dark. He sort of turns on the light. And he has his speech about, I'm always watching you, basically, and threatens with a hammer before it goes up the chimney. But when we cut it just felt like it was one ending too many. It's always a classical thing. But also, I really, when we were cutting it together, I felt like it should end like a Christmas movie. It's got to end on that flying away into the moon, saying Merry Christmas.
So was it a reshot ending, or you just cut a chunk out of it?
Yeah, cut a chunk out of it. So the end that we have now is, it was kind of it's a beautiful shot where he flies into the moon, saying ho, 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 all that stuff. But originally, yes, it goes to dark after that, and he shows up at that house. That's kind of a bonus thing, I guess.
Yeah, it was like an epilogue.
Right.
But that is the classic Christmas ending, is like, I got to go finish my delivery. Yeah. And Santa flies away.
Ding, ding, ding,
like,
ding,
that's
ding,
like
ding,
the ending
ding,
to
ding,
like,
ding,
ding. The Christmas episode of any kind of kids cartoon or whatever, which like seemed appealing.
Exactly. Regarding endings, I guess we don't want to spoil it because you haven't seen it, but The Trip.
Right.
And you said, oh yeah, if he pays off the way we hope, we can he's the right guy for this, but the original cut of the trip was so much darker before we cut it. It did not end up like that.
Might not have been the right guy.
I'll show you that old thing. It was so dark.
I want to see the other ending.
So tell me about the experience of reshooting. Did you have any reshoots on this one?
No.
But on Hansel and Gretel, I assume you did?
No, we actually... I never done any reshoots on any of my film, but on Hansel and Gretel, we did something, again, new to me, what they call a marketing shoot. So what they... And this is, I guess, the craziness of the studios and how much money they have. But when I pitched Hansel and Gretel, there was no other fairy tale movies out there. They said they bought the pitch, but they sat on it for a year and a half, or almost 2 years. So during that time, there was a couple of fairy tale movies getting made. There was a Red Riding Hood one, and there was Snow White and the Huntsman.
Right.
And Snow White and the Huntsman had just come out while we were in production, I believe, and it was a big hit. And I don't know if you remember that trailer of that film. It was a great trailer with a lot of great slow-mo. And I love slow-mo, watching it. I don't use much slow-mo in my movies. I never done that did that. But so we get a call from marketing saying, Tommy, we're going to shoot some stuff just for the trailer, like big, big slow-motion stuff. Like, what? What do you mean? No, because we want to sell it. And Snow White and Huntsman, they had great success.
So we want to do what somebody else did successfully.
Yes, yeah, so like, but... But I said to them, well, I always hate when I see a trailer and there's tons of stuff that's not in the movie. So can you send me what you're planning on shooting for this stuff? And they sent me like this kill and this kill and this kill. And so I asked if can I try to rewrite them slightly so I can actually cut them into my film. And they agreed to that. So it was a marketing shoot, but we brought those stuff into
it
the
ended
film.
Up that's in
great.
The movie.
That's smart to actually like use the extra little bit of budget.
That's great.
But still, I do feel when I watch the movie, it sticks out. Suddenly, like there's all this fast Sam Raimi stuff, and then there's this slow motion, beautiful turning into dust stuff that doesn't even fit the film.
But people don't feel cheated by not having something that they saw in the trailer.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What about the marketing? How do you feel about Violent Night, which, well, I was there at, I think, was the first ever screening of it at Screenfest.
A couple of
test screening. Okay, yeah, well, let's talk about the test screening. How did the first test screening go, the first time you ever saw it with an audience?
So we tested it twice, and the first test screening out in Orange was like the Beyond Fest screening, almost as good.
Yeah, was like a rock concert. People were...
Yes, and this crazy test screening was so good. And the studio was so excited. We scored so high, and everybody was just thrilled. And
don't do another one.
No, and I didn't want it. Like, nobody really wanted it, but they had 3 tests planned, but I said, let's just do one more, and if you want to try some stuff. And we did, and we tested it in Burbank that time.
You do some rearranging?
Yes. So we put in a lot more jokes, and we extended some scenes, and it was actually really interesting. I don't like that process in general. I get... the idea of seeing a film with a crowd and feel the energy and see what works and doesn't. I don't like the scoring cards and all that stuff, but I'm glad the studio gets confidence in that and all that stuff. But we did a second screening, and
it was the first one that we went to. Yeah. Was the second one.
And it went really well. It didn't go as well, and it was actually really interesting just to see how these tiny things we put back in kind of messed with the balance a little bit. There was too many jokes. Like, a scene ended on a joke where it shouldn't, and it was like... It messed a little bit with the energy.
Your instincts were correct the first time around.
Yeah, it was. And we basically just cut out that stuff, did some tiny more tweaks, and that was it.
Now, as the writers watching it with an audience for the first time, tell me about that experience.
Well, what was funny is because we weren't at the first one, so we were at the second one, and it went great. But then we were walking out, and Pat and I were like, wow! And then we're looking around at, like, our Universal exec and everybody.
Tommy's going, you should have been at the first one.
Yeah, and everyone's like, it was like their grandmother died. And it's like, guys, we got to figure this out. And we're like, what?
Yeah, that movie killed. What are you guys talking about?
The Orange audience versus the Burbank audience.
But that was also the first, like, we hadn't seen any cut at that point. So it was good to see it with the audience, but it's also like the first time you see it.
Yeah.
You're so fixated on like, oh, where'd that line go? And what the, you know.
So
like,
you couldn't
just,
watch
like, really...
it as a regular audience member.
Fest, that was... By that point, we'd fully absorbed
the
finished cut of the movie and could, like, fully enjoy it.
Yeah, seeing it with that Beyond Fest crowd,
that was great. And I'm so glad that you guys had us see it there rather than a screener or something. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, it's the movie theater where I shot the opening of Sleepwalkers. So it had great history for me, the whole dance sequence
with
Machen. Yeah. But to see that it's become the Cinematheque, but sold out... And they were rowdy as hell. And I haven't been to a rowdy movie in a long time. And they were so joyous and appreciative that, you know, I always say horror and comedy are best shared. And you got both of them there, big time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope everyone goes to see it. I'm really happy that it's an in-theaters only release.
Yeah.
Because I know this day and age, if you can see it at home, it's very tempting.
Yeah, you don't want to watch it on Peacock first.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, like, right from the beginning, like we always knew, I mean, the idea for the movie is so ridiculous. And the fact that it is, like, played kind of mostly deadpan, so it's not like tons of jokes, it's fewer bigger jokes that will get huge laughs, like if you're with a crowd,
like the comedy works like gangbusters. And like I said, that's rarely the effect that most horror comedies have.
But we always envision this playing to theaters full of people. Like, that's like really how it's meant to be watched. Not because it requires the gigantic screen or whatever, like Avatar, but because of the benefit of having the people around you and everyone laughing together.
Share and fear are contagious. Yeah. So, Tommy, what are your favorite Christmas horror movies?
Christmas horror movies. I mean, Gremlins, we discussed earlier. That's a one I absolutely loved, obviously. And again, when I was a kid, watching that kitchen fight and the Gremlin, like, that's such a favorite.
With the blender.
Microwave and all that stuff. You know, but one film that I had on VHS that I watched a lot of times was Silent Night, Deadly Night. And
where Linnea gets put on the antlers.
My favorite kill in that one is actually where they go sleighing. Is that what you say? Yeah, like they go down the hill and he steps out mid. Because I think, is it parents or friends are waiting at the bottom? So they are sleighing down the hill and Santa steps out with this axe and they cut away. And then you cut to the people waiting at the bottom of the hill. It's like, are they coming? And the head just comes rolling down.
It's funny, we're in a world where we can talk about my favorite kill is. Yeah. So, Pat, what about you?
I mean, Gremlins. I mean, it is funny, though, because Violent Night is more of an action movie than a horror movie, even though it kind of has the kills of a slasher movie.
Yeah.
It's like a heroic slasher. But, you know, it's like just like the... like The Long Kiss Goodnight and like other kind of Christmas action movies, of which there haven't been enough, which is also why we wanted to make this one.
Right.
To add to the Christmas action canon.
I was going to say I'm a big fan of Silent Night, Deadly Night 5, Toymaker.
Okay, we're really getting in the weeds now.
Once we get into the Brian Yuzna phase of the franchise. Yeah. I also just think it's so funny.
Is that the one with Mickey Rooney?
Yeah, because growing up, for the people who don't know listening, Mickey Rooney very famously came out against Silent Night, Deadly Night 1 when it actually got banned and like pulled from the theater, and he had like a big newspaper, like, not expose is not
editorial.
The word,
yeah,
but just like railing against how dare they do this to Christmas,
to our beloved Santa.
Cut to 4 movies later and he's starring in one of them.
Rare Exports may be my favorite Christmas movies. It's so brilliant and so original, and you know, there's a lot to be said about the Norwegian sense of humor too, or the Scandinavian sense of humor. And
was that popular in Norway?
No, it wasn't that popular, but it was a known movie.
Norwegians hate the Finns.
I actually think my production designer, again, that I studied with and worked with, I think she did that one, actually.
Really? Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just really imaginative. It looks beautiful. And yours is, too. Tell me about how the production balance was between location and studio work.
Well, we built the entire mansion interior.
So you could go up 2 floors and
well,
all
that
of
was,
that was
we didn't
practical.
Have money to build 2 floors. So I have to give a credit to our production designer, Roger Fires, who came up with this idea of basically every single room has different, wallpaper on the side. So you basically just flip the walls.
Really?
Yeah, like a theater.
So you you'd have stairs that lead up but start over again on the other set.
Yes, and the bedrooms are downstairs. We flip the walls, and there's a bedroom upstairs. And we actually reused the big dining hall, the big giant room. After we'd done shooting there, we redressed it to be the barn where he takes on the 20 mercenaries. So we reused a lot of those sets.
And like the attic was also the interior of the cabin where Scrooge and Santa fight, right?
It was very cool to look at the set because, like, again,
recycling is great.
Coming off of like the Sonic movies, like those had more money, and a Sonic 1 like shot in one of the biggest warehouses in Vancouver. So you walk in there, and it's like each room is like its own little island with like nothing else around it in the soundstage,
including like the house where James Marsden lives. Like they built like basically the entire house on the set, you know, just surrounded by a big curtain, but you could walk in and walk around like a full size, basically functional house.
But yeah, it was like the Violent Night. It was a much smaller soundstage, and yeah, Roger used it so smartly. It was like a weird little jigsaw. Almost like an M.C. Escher's kind of puzzle of stairwells and very contained.
But I guess the biggest challenge on that side was, because we shot it in Winnipeg because they have a 40% rebate.
Right.
But there was two things apparently that they didn't have, which was mansions or hills.
So mansion, that's why it's so windy.
Yes. So mansion, the exterior, we just found out a big house and we do CGI to extend it. That was easy, but the hill was a much more complicated thing where Santa runs down the sleigh and intersects the snowmobiles. So we looked and we looked and we couldn't, I'm not joking, we couldn't find a single hill anywhere. So we actually built it with like 50 truckloads of snow.
You built a hill.
So we built a hill. But that was, I guess...
Made a mountain out of a mole.
Yeah. But that, again, like, so I tell this story because it's so funny. This, again, like some of the big filmmaking minds of... I remember we had a meeting about building this hill, and there was like all the suggestion, well, should we build like this railing underneath for safety? And this was like, what are you talking about? Just it's snow. Just put it on top of each other. Yeah. Make a big pile of snow. Yeah, I don't know. Is it safe?
Yeah, like putting snow over a structure, then the structure could collapse. Like, that makes it dangerous.
That kind of happens.
The snow is not going to collapse. The snow is snow.
So how do you plan to spend opening night?
Opening night, well, we are doing that Q&A at the Alamo Draft House, and I was hoping to sneak into a couple of screenings as well. It's playing in IMAX, so I want to sneak into one of those.
Yeah. See what it looks and sounds like in there.
Yeah.
So you've got a nose around the theaters that it's opening in, particularly in areas like the Valley and the like.
So. Yeah. And I actually have a lot of Norwegians coming in for the premiere, so that's always fun.
Well, I want to wish you happy holidays in every way. And thank you guys for coming and sharing your stories with us. And can't wait to see it become a big hit for you.
Thank you.
Knock on wood. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.